heavy sound. Smoke, steam, and body funk from the Midwest. Grand Funk, a bruising, blasting, electric vibration is a railroad for its generation. And running like a clockwork orange, right on its time. What is the actual story behind the biggest American rock group of all time? What has made gold records out of all the band's albums? Over 1.5 million of E Pluribus Funk, their sixth to date, going in just a few short months. What is there to say about a trio that acts like an atomic magnet on the incredibly fringe, sometimes riotous, and always, always record-breaking crowds it attracts everywhere it gigs all over the world? Yet what explains the simultaneous non-attraction of the press? Who or what is responsible for this media relationship as distant between the parties as the long road Grand Funk has come in its two short yet triumphant years? How does one account for their amazing financial and popular success in such a short period of time? Who are they? How did they get here? What makes them so controversial? As rapid as their rise has been, success on their present scale did not come immediately to Mark Farner, Don Brewer, Mel Schasher, or their producer-manager, in many ways key associate, if not downright captain, Terry Knight. Sometime in the middle of the 1960s, Terry Knight, at the age of 20, suddenly found himself to be a big-time disc jockey, making $25,000 a year in Detroit. With equal suddenness, he found himself released and out on the street, where he discovered that he himself had an ambition to be a rock star. Hip to himself, Terry Knight set out to found his own band, and did. The group he formed was known as Terry Knight in the Pack. It received a measure of renown around the Michigan area, but unfortunately in not too many other areas. Among its members were, of course, Terry himself, Don Brewer, and for a short time, Mark, who worked as a substitute bassist. Terry eventually abandoned the Pack to seek his fortune in New York. With Knight gone, the group groped through a number of changes. One of these involved the addition of Mel Schasher, who'd for a time been playing for a group called Question Mark and the Mysterians. Although you may remember the group for a big hit the group produced called 96 Tears, Mel is reluctant to talk about that and other early experiences. As he puts it, all of us knocked around in nothing bands then. None of that matters now. We all know how difficult it is for a new band to find an identity, a message, its own sound groove. It will struggle. There will be arguments over style and content. Many directions will be taken before a single road is stamped out and all the major experimenting ended. Grand Funk's beginnings represent no exception to the rule. In fact, the group's origins might be termed even more muddled, since an unusually large number of musicians came and went before the basic formula on which future success was to be banked was decided on. So out of all this shuffling internal to Terry Knight's old group emerged the nucleus of the present Grand Funk. Only at that time, Mark, Mel, and Don called themselves the Fabulous Pack. The band still hadn't found itself in the winter of 1969, unless by that you mean finding yourself in New England without any money, which is exactly what happened to the Fabulous Pack. They were forced to sell their instruments for bread in order to get home. And when they got back, Don put in a historic phone call to Terry Knight asking for help. We can only suppose that it was a karmic combination of fate and intuition that made the boys think of reuniting with their former leader. Terry Knight is one hard cat to forget once he gets stamped on that photo plate in the back of your mind. Putting the heavy fate trip aside for a moment, there was a lot of good sound logic in the boys' decision. Knight was older, had been around, was a good strong leader, which the foundering band needed, and basically he understood how to protect his interests. In every way, the return of Terry Knight heralded completion to the mixture needed for success. The last missing ingredient was added, and the phenomenal bubbling alchemy that was to froth his funk set in motion when sorcerer Terry Knight signed on to produce and manage Mark, Mel, and Don. The town of Flint is just north of Detroit in Michigan. It's populated mostly with factory workers from General Motors' enormous Buick and Chevrolet plants. It is from here that the boys, Terry Knight included, hail. All are in their early 20s, with the exception of Knight, who is 28. Quite young ages for success of the magnitude they have experienced. In fact, pretty young for any kind of success, if not too young. Yet all the boys' good fortune has not gone to their heads. They are not snobs, arrogant, or as a friend of Mark says, on ego trips like other musicians in rock bar. They're not like the Beatles were. So, how are they? Now, 2 years after having to travel to Atlanta for the Pop Festival in a rented Volkswagen van, they continue to travel, only by airplane, and continue to rap about the revolution with all the brothers and sisters in the audience. All this when at the same time the band is an incorporated $20 million enterprise. Don Brewer is the wildly popular drummer with the jungle-dense frizzy hair, the exuberant, vibrant, non-stop rhythm machine setting beat background for the heavy electric energy up front, and author of those incredible extended free solos set winging in such cuts as TNUC. He's 22 and lives at home with his mother. Don receives a moderately large allowance from the Grand Funk Corporation, and his birth sign is Pisces. Art Farner, the out-of-sight guitarist with straight blonde hair almost down to the tough armband he wears around his bicep, has a lot of raw appeal. Maybe this is because of his frequent predilection for dancing on stage without wearing a shirt. He really knows how to shake that half-naked muscular torso and those golden locks for full effect in front of that huge, wild, screeching assemblage of brothers and sisters. Mark writes most of the group's lyrics and resides on a horse ranch on the outskirts of Flint. He's very seriously interested and concerned with ecological issues. He rides a motorcycle instead of an automobile. He feels it pollutes the air less. Mark performs most of the band's works on vocals, and he was born under the sign of Libra. More about his involvement with ecology later. Mel Shasher is the group's bassist, born under the sign of Aries. Quiet and thoughtful, Mel's face communicates a great deal less moroseness, although it is really dark and intense, than do the tough, foreboding photos of him carrying an axe as he is shown on the Gimme Shelter album. In addition to the pickaxe, Mel is seen dressed in fur and standing in a cave. The overall effect is pretty menacing. Shasher is really unbelievably skinny. He has a waist size of 22 inches, according to Terry Knight. When he performs in front of those huge amps on stage, vibrating so fast with all that power steering through his slight build, almost blurring him out of focus, his audience effect, like the energy he uses so well, is electric. Mel, possibly expressing the whole band's feelings about music, explains the sharp contrast between his ferocious onstage and his tamer, far more personable offstage manner on the grounds that performing satisfies a powerful need for energy release. To retreat from the crowds and to obtain more privacy, as everyone, even rock stars, must, Mel likes to spend his own time in the basement of his own home, where the walls are completely paneled with shelves holding stereo equipment and hundreds of long-playing records, along with Mel's own public address system. Shasher spends a great deal of time at home and everywhere else with his girlfriend, Dina, who at one time was only a fan. Dina's dream-come-true relationship with her idol began in St. Louis, where the pair met following a gig by Funk. Dina describes the soft waterbed in Mel's basement room as a comfortable place to relax. It's as obvious as the mustache on Frank Zappa's face that the tenor of the group's triumphs has not appreciably affected the modest, down-to-earth quality of the boys' lives. Yet the extraordinary indifference of Grand Funk's musicians to success is compensated for by the driving energy, brutal frankness, and overwhelming promotional genius of Terry Knight. Terry's ability to handle all of the aspects of travel, advertising, recording, press releases, more about this later, recording contracts, and business in general compensates for the boys' own dislike of business involvement and enables the musicians to spend much more of their time thinking and planning new music, as musicians ought to anyway. Terry gives the Grand Funk Railroad enterprise a fine balance in the overall structure of what it's all about. And Grand Funk is as surely about more than just music as there is more to Raquel Welch than her just being an actress. More about this later, too. To understand the railroad means, to a large extent, to understand its promoter, this man, Terry Knight, his own personal philosophy of life, and what he thinks Grand Funk is all about. We can only imagine what this experience, this celestial taste of success, had done to him. When Terry Knight failed as a disc jockey and then as a performer, he became only that much more determined to climb back up, all the way back up to the top, even if it was going to have to be in the role of the power behind the throne. You might say that the kick is akin to being like a Secretary of State Dulles to an Eisenhower, or today, a Henry Kissinger to a President Nixon. Not that Terry Knight thinks that the throne, undisputedly occupied by rock's reigning kings, the Grand Funk Railroad, is more rightfully his own than Mark, Mel, or Don's. Quite the contrary. Knight is a dean of modesty with respect to his contribution to the band's winning sound. where some critics have gone even so far as to suggest that Terry Knight writes some, if not all, of the group's material, or choreographed how it is arranged and performed, he angrily and quickly moves to debunk this kind of talk as nonsense. Terry will be just as ready and likely to launch himself on a long philosophical discourse about the prophetic message the boys, who are the spokesmen for their generation, Terry feels, brings to man. All this will be done in order to clarify his role, the function Terry feels he fulfills with the railroad in his own head, and one definitely not related to choreographing their act. The way Knight thinks about himself in relation to Grand Funk is that he is the Oracle's interpreter, the medium through which his prophetic message is expressed. Knight is deeply involved with the consciousness of cosmic energy in crowds. Do you have any idea what it's like to be on stage, man? The power to make thousands of people stand on their feet and scream, he has said. It's the sort of thing you can never truly understand unless you've actually done it yourself. Terry Knight used to sing in front of some of those big crowds when he led the pack. In fact, he had a hit single which you may remember, I Who Have Nothing. Perhaps the power he was unable intuitively to find and unharness and make work for himself, Knight came to understand in a more objective way and eventually utilize with funk. Because, man, Terry's railroad really reaches out and grabs, practically ionizes masses of people, and in the places where they are wired for it the most. Slender, intense, shaggy-haired with a beard, so humorless you can hear a pin drop to the floor, loud as a Led Zeppelin if anyone tries to make a joke anywhere in his vicinity, Terry is a formidable and very voluble spokesman indeed. An appearance of the Grand Funk Railroad, the announcement of an appearance of the Grand Funk Railroad, does not announce a musical concert. It signals a convention. It hails a gathering of people. It's an exchange of thoughts and ideas. It is politics that supersedes music, according to Knight. What we have here is a quote which illustrates very beautifully an extremely astute understanding of musical power. It also says something important, incidentally, about power's relation to politics. We all know where that's at. We might already have an inkling about the manic way Terry Knight has of getting excited about something. When really interested, Terry's words come jumping and cascading like an electric waterfall or one of Mark Farner's frenzied riffs. It doesn't take very much to get Terry going either, so he gets excited pretty often. Here's what the man has to say about music. One thing they gotta realize is that rock and roll has got nothing to do with music. I think that the press, the media, have dealt with the group in terms of their music, when the most important communication they're making to their audience is not what they're playing or singing. What is it then? This experience, maybe that's the only thing we can call it, is communicating, if not the simple, direct, pleasurable enjoyment of music. This sort of question surfaces every time an Elvis Presley pelvis twitch rocks a generation to life. Every time some solid, urgent beat is the sound everyone wants to hear and feel. And an epidemic of some madness such as Beatlemania starts to tidal wave a population. It can come from anywhere and usually does. America's Deep South or Liverpool, it doesn't matter. It will always be unexpected. It will always be gloriously welcome. It will always be impossible to describe, because there will always be something differently unique about the sound. Critics will overreach themselves trying to put it into words, and will more often than not be forced to resort to religious parallels to do it. According to Terry Knight, the man closest to the sound of Grand Funk, from the point of view of someone outside the actual sound, we get the uncharacteristically short comment, "Playing or singing comes second with the group." A statement which may imply either that the boys are better actors than they are musicians, or that they are some sort of spiritual beings in touch with the energy common to all their peers, and that it is like this, more than music, which Funk's audiences come to partake of and share in with each other in the celebration of a concert. A moment ago, we spoke of the need for religious or spiritual language to describe some of the feelings involved in some of the big sound experiences. Is it possible to talk about some of the things Grand Funk does up on that stage without talking about ritual? Can we describe the meaning of Mark ripping off his shirt, or Mel tearing off his vest, or stomping around with that axe without bringing up the subject of symbols? We all know that rock stars tend to be revered as gods. To what extent is that reverence justified? This is a question which terrifies many straight people. The possibility that our society's young may actually be in touch with the other world. Terry Knight says flatly, the establishment is afraid of Grand Funk Railroad. But to what extent is the audience's predisposition to idolizing stars exploited by the performers and a conscious thing to them? Or is it all just theater? There are those who seriously say that a group with three musicians evoke a Trinitarian power. How much of this and other similar sort of Kabbalistic speculation on rock should be explored seriously? Perhaps we will all be better able to judge on the meaning and the significance of the Grand Funk's Trinity's ritual after we listen to the following quote from Terry Knight on the Railroad's act. What the audience is hearing and seeing is Mark holding his guitar over his head and saying, "You see this, brothers and sisters? You see me? I'm free. I own this stage. It's mine and it's yours, and we're free and you can be free." Donnie is saying it also when he holds his sticks above his head. He's not doing that consciously, saying, "These are my sticks and I'm holding them up above my head. See them?" But he holds them there and I see it. I can see Mel when he throws that bass up there like that. I can see him in front of that huge amp and his body feels. It's like a battery charger, and then he's full of that. I mean really physically full, his body charged. He blows off away from the amp and throws that bass up in the air, and the audience come right straight up with it. I think that is what the symbol of is. I'm free. A free bird. I can fly. I'm a lion. I can run. I'm a human being. But I'm doing what I want, and nobody can tell me not to. Steve Whaley writes for a newspaper started by Mark Farner and Flint called the Freedom Rider. Its purpose is to talk about the dream waiting for the people and the power to make it a reality, as one of Mark's own slogans written specially for the paper goes. The tabloid represents an attempt to channel the power of funk's rock music from music into another medium. This paper also, incidentally, was one of the things Terry Knight is referring to when he spoke of an announcement of a concert of Grand Funk's heralding an exchange of thoughts and ideas, among other things. Steve, who is close to funk and a personal friend of Mark's, has this to say about the group. "It doesn't really matter if their music isn't as skillful, perhaps, as others. It's just as real. I think it's a free experience. That's what revolution is all about. We are after the type of freedom that you can feel when you completely lose yourself at a rock concert. There is totally nothing else in your mind or head. You aren't even aware of your body. All you're aware of is electric sounds." Perhaps this is what Terry Knight was talking about when he said that rock has nothing to do with music. The power of Grand Funk seems to be in the band's ability to create a cosmically complete physical environment, an atmosphere where everything we might think of as thought and its related freedom-limiting hang-ups is totally impossible, where the body is so overloaded with electrical energy that it becomes numbed, and then acting like a spark plug on the mind, triggers off, cannonballing the mind into the bodiless state we might relate to Satori. Again, we find ourselves in the employ of the spiritual. We are caught using religious language, only this time from the East rather than the West. Yes, it's only a small wonder that where the frequency of spiritual imagery and heavy rock criticism is the greatest, where there's this tremendous volume of sound and that fuzzy, grating bass swallowing us up from the inside when it's played, the whole thing simply and best described as heavy. That's where it's found. In all likelihood, it's subject to be one which produces an atmosphere unbelievably dense, physically dense with energy. There are few groups either louder or heavier than the Grand Funk Railroad Trio. One can never truly lose the sense of wonder how just three people can create such shattering and awesome a volume of sound, yet have it under control, yeah, and structure it full of meaning and enjoyment. Because as anyone old enough to watch Sesame Street can tell you, it's not how much noise you make, but what kind of noise you produce. Steve Whaley mentioned the word revolution a ways back. That should be picked up on because it's important with respect to both what the group is all about and also to the lives of everyone else. We all know how today's music, with a capital T, and we know that capital is funk's recording label, pun unintended though, means freedom with a capital F. Music today is an electric joyride meant to bring us closer to home, as the third Railroad album is titled, and to a place where we are all free all the time. This is the implication of home. But music cannot keep us liberated all the time. though it can help us forget and overcome all the things wrong with the world, and even help pull us through when our own personal lives might be a drag, providing us with welcome, brief interludes of solace and joy, we know that music cannot liberate us all the time. We are aware of the fact, and to the varying extents we do something to make the world and our lives better, liberation should be a 100% of the time concern.